My name is Craig Martinez. I'm a doctorate of public health candidate at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. I'd like to acknowledge my faculty advisor, Dr. Kathleen Roche, who's also my co-author in this paper. I'm going to talk a little bit today, talk about acculturation marijuana use, particularly among Mexican-American youth. And I'm specifically I'm interested in looking at the impact of friendship networks, so looking at peers and friends, and what sort of impact that has on the relationship that we will talk about. I have no relationships to disclose, so I just will jump right into it. So marijuana is the most commonly used illicit drug among adolescents in the United States. Of course, it's not including alcohol. We know that 21% of Mexican-American 8th graders used marijuana during the past 12 months from 1991 to 2002. And why that's important is because they had the highest rates among all other 8th graders of different races, ethnicities, and among Hispanics by country of origin. So this is a particularly young population using a lot of marijuana. We also know that approximately 40% of Hispanics, 9th through 12th graders, use marijuana at least once during their lifetime. And it's important to notice that I use Hispanics there. One of the main problems we have is, although there are some estimates, national estimates for particular populations, they're not always reported. And we know that among Hispanics, that different populations by country of origin use at different rates, and they use different drugs. So there's a lot of stuff we don't know because of that. Well, why is this important? Let's talk about the effects of marijuana. Marijuana is associated with 70,000 emergency department visits among 12 to 20-year-olds in 2005. There's also a lot of concern about marijuana being a gateway drug, marijuana-associated, cannabinoid-associated psychoses. We also know that among 57% of male and 32% of female juvenile arrestees, they tested positive for marijuana use in 2002. So although that may be, we don't know if it's cause or effect, we do know that it is associated and that it is related to deviant behaviors. 21% of sexually active Hispanics, 9th through 11th graders, also used drugs and alcohol in 2007, which is particularly problematic when it comes to HIV transmission, unintended pregnancies, and that sort of thing. So I know there's a lot of debate about is marijuana benign or not, but it is associated with a number of adverse effects, and it's important to keep that in your mind and the social costs it have. So what are some of the predictors of marijuana use that we know about? Well, we know that typically English speakers, among the Hispanic populations, that English speakers are more likely to use as Spanish speakers. We also know that U.S.-born youth are more likely to use than foreign-born youth. And although there's a lot of research on acculturation, and this doesn't necessarily look into, there may be a lot of different factors. We talk about acculturation. It's a multidimensional process. It's not just about learning English. It's not about where you're born. There are a lot of other factors in there. But these two, language and nativity, are very strong proxies of the acculturation process, and they have been used in the literature. We also know that male youth are more likely to use than female youth. But we know that traditional females are less likely to use than non-traditional females, and typically that's been measured looking at cultural norms, that women who are from strong families where they very much believe in traditional cultural roles, they're less likely to engage in substance use than those who are not. And finally, peer substance use, having friends who engage in substance use. So if you have friends that use, you're more likely to use. We've known this for a while, but interesting thing, when you put this into perspective of Mexican-Americans, Hispanics, we know that immigrants are less susceptible to peer influence. What is the effect of peers on this particular population? So I tried to put that all together, and I came up with two research aims. First, to investigate the association between acculturation and marijuana use among Mexican-American youth, and then specifically examine the impact of school friendship networks on the association between acculturation and marijuana among Mexican-American youth. That's a lot to wrap your mind about. So let's take a walk through a few of the relevant theories. Just to give you a sense of where my thinking was coming. An important theory that I looked at was acculturation theory, and there's two aspects of it, there's two tenets of it. First, socio-cultural adaptation, so the ability to fit in. So when a young person comes from another country, they come to this country, they want to fit in, they want to be able to act like the people who are from the dominant culture, so they tend to act like, that they're going to be influenced by what other people around them are doing so they can fit in. And also, if we've heard talk a lot about psychological adaptation, change in affect, that substance use may actually be a coping mechanism. When you move to a new country, it's very stressful, you're kind of trying to learn things, your parents may not necessarily be that helpful because they're not familiar with the cultural tradition, so this may be a way to adapt and to use as a coping mechanism. Also looking at some of the more deviant theories in deviancy in terms of social control, that weak social bonds permit deviance and differential associations, that you're more that if you're hanging out with people who are more favorable to deviance, you're more likely to be a deviant individual. But what I wanted to add to this is the social network analysis. So social, can we move to the next slide? Thank you. Social network is a set of interacting units in their relationships. Social structure shapes social phenomena. So specifically, it's not necessarily, it's about the relationships. So it's not only the people who are around you, but the people, what sort of impact they have on you, and how do they influence you. And specifically looking at school friendship networks in schools can structure the association between school friends, delinquency, and adolescents' own delinquency. So particularly when it comes to acculturation, a lot of the times the schools are where a lot of immigrant youth become familiar what is the norms of the dominant culture. So these schools, in a lot of respect, are the cultural brokers. So this is a really sort of important context to examine. I used data from the National Longitudinal Study of Alice in Health, specifically looked at the first two waves of data collected in 94, 95, and 1996. It's a multi-stage stratified sample of Mexican-American 9th through 11th graders who completed an in-school questionnaire and in-home interviews at both wave one and wave two. And I specifically looked at respondents with no prior history of marijuana use at the baseline. So I'm looking at marijuana initiation among these individuals. The sample size was 264. When it comes to, I don't know, people who've done social network analysis, these individuals have complete network analyses data, and it's very difficult to collect that data. It's a lot of work. So although we had, it seems like a particularly small sample given how many they collected, actually finding the youth with all the complete social network data was pretty difficult. My dependent measure was past month marijuana use at time one, so the second assessment. During the past 30 days, how many times did you use marijuana? So that was a continuous scale. Independent variables, talked a little bit about this already, the language. What language is usually spoken at home, Spanish or English? There was a very small percentage of those who spoke others, but we dropped them from the sample because we just weren't sure what other was, and it's not easy to really deal with that. And also looked at nativity. Were you born in the United States, and was your mother or father born in the United States? Given the distribution, we created binary response, first generation, and then second generation or greater. So looking at the school friendship networks, so within At Health, individual youth are able to identify 5 male friends and 5 female friends from a school roster, so the roster of their own schools, and then a sister school. So they were able to actually go through and pick out, these are my friends, and you know, this is who they are, type of thing. And using that information, we can create a number of school friendship attributes, so looking at their networks, from their peer assessment. So you're not asking your friends, well, how many of your friends, you know, use drugs? You're actually asking them, who are your friends, and then going back to their self-assessments. So it kind of prevents some of that. Young people tend to say that my friends use more than I do. It kind of makes them more normative. And these are the 4 measures that we looked at. And I have a little animated slide here that can kind of get into this a little bit more. But density. Oh, they didn't include it. Okay, well, density is cohesion of relationships. So how, like, when you're in a network, so you have individuals, how many times do your friends say that they're friends with each other? I'm friends with you, you know, and I'm friends with you, but how often are you guys friends with each other? So how cohesive is that network? Ethnic diversity, looking at the ethnic origin of friends, so looking at the number of races and ethnicities represented in your social network. Number of female friends. And finally, the number of past year drunk. So it's the mean number of heavy drinkers in your social network. It would have been ideal to have marijuana use, but unfortunately, when you do secondary data analysis, you use what you have. So this was kind of an indication of any sort of heavy substance abuse in your social network. Also looked at background variables, age, female sex, family attachment, highest parental education was kind of our proxy for socioeconomic status, family structure, and highest parental past year drinking. Again, just to get a sense, like in the family environment, how often do your parents actually engage in substance use? And this is my little I'm going to go to the next slide. So essentially, when you're talking about social network analysis, you're looking at the ego. That's the center person. So this is my Mexican-American youth. And you look, so you look at their friends are considered alters. So you take a look at, this is your perspective from the ego's perspective. You look at their alters, which is just another word for their friends. So that's like I said, this person nominated 5 other people. So the first measure I used was density. Go ahead. Thank you. So just like the relationships between your friends, The second measure was racial heterogeneity. So just figuring out whether or not there are a diversity of individuals in your friendship network. Unfortunately, I can't specifically say who those friends are. I just know whether or not it's diverse or if it's not diverse. The third measure was just the number, mean number of females in your social network. And the fourth measure was past year, mean past year drunk among the alters. So how many of those individuals had gotten drunk in the past year? So we'll go to the results. Demographic characteristics, mean age 16.1, female sex 58%. More than half of the population spoke Spanish at home, and 20% were first generation. And then looking at past month marijuana use at time one, the prevalence of past month use was 22%, so 22% of my population that hadn't initiated at time zero had initiated. It ranged from a number of times from 1 to 100. It was very much skewed, so a lot of individuals used 3 or 4 times a month, and there were a few people who used a lot. And then the mean number of times among users was 14. So these are just Bivariate associates. I used a negative binomial since there's only 22% who actually engaged, I had a lot of non-users who continued to be non-users. So I had a lot of people who just kind of stayed absent the whole time. So when you're looking at the Bivariate associations, we see that English language was positively predictive engaging in marijuana use. And we also see that sex here is actually female sex. So that if you're a female, you're less likely to use the male. There's no surprise. That's what we've been finding previously. And then we looked specifically at the social network analysis. We find that those young people who were in school friendship networks that were diverse were more likely to use. If they were to have more female friends in their network, they're less likely to use. And if they have a number of people who engage in past year who got drunk in the past year, they're also more likely to use. So these are bivariate associations. And we also see that English language associated racial heterogeneity, mean number of drunks. So essentially, if you speak English, you're more likely to hang out with other kids who are racially distinct from yourself, and that you're also more likely to hang out with people who had engaged in past year drunk. And that it was negatively associated with density in female sex. And nativity positively associated female sex. So if you were born here, or you're more likely to hang out with women, and also negatively associated with racial heterogeneity and mean number of drunk. So what's more interesting is looking at the bivariate associations. When I included my control variables and looked at the acculturation variables and the friendship networks, English language was no longer predictive. Additionally, female sex was no longer predictive. So those indicators were no longer predictive of engaging in past month marijuana use, using negative binomial models. If you go to the next slide, please. But we do find that ethnic diversity remains persistent, so that if you're hanging out with a lot of racially diverse kids, you're still more likely to engage in past year marijuana use. And also, female friends no longer was significant, but the number of friends who got drunk persisted to be significant. So again, if you're hanging out with a lot of people who are engaging in heavy alcohol use, you're more likely to engage in past month marijuana use. Looking at some of the indirect effects, we found that English language was more strongly associated with marijuana use initiation for males. So this relationship between English language and marijuana use was stronger among males. And we also found that in terms of mediation, that English language appears to be mediated by having friends who were drunk, which in turn led to marijuana use. And this is what we were able to use because we used two time periods, two assessments. So just coming into this, going along to the summary. Among 9th through 11th grade Mexican Americans, we find that English language is positively associated with initiation of marijuana use, and this is especially true among males. We also know that friendship networks with higher number of drunk friends and greater ethnic diversity is associated with initiation of marijuana use. Friendship networks with higher number of drunk friends mediated the association between English language and marijuana use. That's just kind of summing up what we found. But what does this mean? So one of the things I was thinking about is it seems that when you use English, you're more likely to have adopted marijuana use possibly of the dominant culture. So if you're more likely to engage in English use, that there's something about being here in this country, something about being surrounded by other people from this country, being able to interact with those people may have a greater notion of what it means to be in this country. You may adopt greater norms. This is all sort of speculative, but in terms of like really sort of making those connections. Higher levels of ethnic diversity of friends who drink fosters more permissive marijuana using norms. So if you're hanging out with people who engage in any type of substance use, you're more likely to engage in substance use, sort of regardless of what the substance is. And school friendships are more proximal to the adoption of permissive marijuana using norms than language use at home. So I think that's interesting when you think about, we talk a lot about acculturation, language use at home, like there's a huge transition. I think a lot of us are trying to figure out what is that connection. You know, when you're growing up speaking English and Spanish at home, how does that, you know, what are the mechanisms there? What sort of like mediates that process and what kind of shapes that process? And some of the strengths and limitations, unfortunately, like I said, these are only using proxies of acculturation, so it's a very multidimensional process, but I was only able to find nativity in language. Friendship networks may not be stable, although for the time period we used, it was approximately a year, they find that although your friends may change within a year, the structure, the type of friends you're hanging out, those tend not to change. So, you know, it is one of the limitations. And also, we assume norms and reasons to use. We heard this morning a lot about, I don't know, I'm assuming that these young people are using them to sort of enhance their ability to fit in. But it may also be, you know, they may be using as a coping strategy, and I just wasn't able to tease that out. Some of the strengths is I was able to reduce common source bias using friends reports. So I wasn't asking you to tell me what your friends are doing. I was using you to tell me who your friends were and then using their own reports. It included measures of attributes and network structure. So not just the type of people you're hanging out with, but what is their relationship to one another? What is it about cohesiveness and that sort of thing? And examines initiation of marijuana use by using multiple phases of data collection. So I was able to sort of just look at individuals who had not initiated and kind of figured out what was associated with their initiation longitudinally, as opposed to kind of doing cross-sectional and kind of trying to tease all that out. And that is my presentation. I'd just like to acknowledge Dr. Clea McNeely, assistant professor, who's on my committee and very instrumental to this dissertation that I'm working on. And these are my references, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you, everyone, for your attendance. I'd like to open it up for questions for our panelists, please. Up front row.
In the Unnatural Causes, there's an episode where they show a Latino family, and they talk about how, because of that connectedness in the family network, there's less stress. And even though they're poor, the kids were like, well, nobody told me I was poor. So, you know, and then I moved to Mejero, then to college, where I read the 1% Latino, and they're always asking me, you know, what is this about? Because, you know, some of the faculty participated in Natural Customs, but I'm wondering if you guys can talk a little bit about that family, the Hispanics, and why there's that perception. Or if there's not a perception, why is that true of Hispanic and other ethnic?
Remember, we're also getting audio taped, so if we could speak loud also, or if you want to come to the microphone, I welcome that. Whoever would like to respond first. Regarding the Unnatural Causes, the series that was on PBS, and hopefully many of you saw and you haven't, recommend you go on the website, but looking at a Latino family and the family structure and the social networks there, and how children didn't realize that they were poor because that was never expressed to them, pretty much. Is that a sense? Go ahead, panel, please respond.
I'll take a stab at it. I do know that there's some literature out there that takes a look at that, actually, what you just said, and the children don't know that they're poor up until about third or fourth grade, and then they start to see how their family compares to other families in their communities. Now, if it's a poor community, they're not going to see themselves as being any different. If it's a family that does not have what other families have in the neighborhood, it takes children to about third or fourth grade to recognize that my family's different than everybody else. And there is some evidence to suggest that because they are different, they start to then engage in behavior that would be characteristic of what they think they should be doing in terms of a poor family. So I know that there's literature out there on that that sort of indirectly answers your question.
Yeah, the main gist of the question dealt with stress levels and the fact that because there is such a family, we're not so entwined into things that you... A lot of us look at things we want and things we need. And the real question was, is it true that because of our conception of family, we rely more on family rather than things? Our stress level is less, and therefore our mental health when we grow up.
Well, one of the things that I forgot to mention when I was standing on the other side there was that this is true of African immigrants also, that we in this country tend to group all Latinos, Hispanics into one group, and we tend to group all African immigrants. You know, the African immigrants are saying, look, I come from this particular country. I don't come from the continent of Africa. I come from this particular country. And so what they then do is they bring different cultural norms from their country of origin and how they handle stress and how they respond to mental illness. And so I do know Puerto Rican families, for example, are incredibly tight with regard to family and rely very much on their own informal networks in terms of dealing with different types of stress that they encounter. And so there's a buffer, if you will, with Puerto Rican families as compared to maybe some other Latinos from other countries. So, I mean, it's really, some of that is based on country of origin issues.
But I think from my sort of perspective in terms of my understanding of the literature when it comes to peers, I think there's a notion that as you become more acculturated, as you transition from a child into adulthood, that families become less important. But I think what the literature shows that that's not necessarily true, that peers also become just as important. So a lot of the times, even though you're getting older and you're becoming more acculturated, the family persists to be really important. But I think when it really comes to that immigrant experience, that a lot of times your families are not able to negotiate that process for you. So they rely on peers more. Not necessarily saying that families are not important, but that it's also an additional support network that they have. I mean, and you guys understand that better than I do, you know, in terms of words.
I would agree with that, and I also would say, you know, the idea that the heterogeneity in Latino families extends to heterogeneity in family structure and the extent to which both parents are able to be present, and you know, there's a tremendous amount of variability in the ability to maintain that strong family structure for a variety of reasons. But the main thought that I had is that our other studies tend to reinforce this idea that as the children make the transition, particularly from elementary to middle school, that the composition of the school itself can have big influence on the kinds of experiences that we're talking about. That we, in our studies, have lots of kids who attend Latino majority schools. In some cases, are like 90% Mexican heritage kids. And within the school, even, there's tremendous variation in the proportion that are relatively acculturated and non-acculturated or unacculturated. And what we find that this protective effect of the of being from a less acculturated background applies only for the less acculturated kids. That is, the kids who are less acculturated and attending schools where most of their peers are less acculturated, there's this continuation of the protective effect, but not for the more acculturated kids, regardless of how high the proportion of less acculturated kids is in the school. So there's something that goes on, some very complex things at the school level, as Craig was sort of demonstrating. And we need to know a lot more about that, I think.
Dr. Ojeda, did you want to share that? Okay. I think we have another question on the floor, too. Please, the gentleman in the blue jacket.
This may actually be related. I was going to ask Dr. Kulis about the mix in the school populations where you did your study. But you sort of touched on that in your last answer, so I take it they're majority Hispanic school populations?
I was referring to an earlier study that had more diversity in the school compositions. The current study that I just described, all but two of those 30 schools were Mexican heritage majority schools, and some of them up to 96% Mexican. But our other studies had more heterogeneous, diverse kind of populations.
And another question that I had when you were doing your presentation, Dr. Ojeda touched on inhalation drugs of abuse, and I assume by that you mean flu, pain, huffing. Do did you factor that into your study? You talked mostly about marijuana and other traditional drugs of abuse.
Well, we find if the same kinds of effects for inhalants, and we didn't report it here, but in our other studies, we're finding inhalants are very different. We're finding that the things that predict inhalants are somewhat different than for, again, this is for fifth graders, mostly of Mexican heritage. And we're trying to investigate what's going on with inhalants, that the arc of inhalant use tends to, you know, plateau sometime in probably middle school, and it's maybe on the way down, but we're looking into, are they substituting some other substance? We don't really know. Also, I think we're still trying to figure out what kind. We don't have the really detailed measures of what kind of inhalant they're using, and that may, we wonder if there's some cultural norms about what types of substances you should experiment with that may even come from Mexico, and that there's a new learning curve as you arrive in the United States and find other substances that you can inhale. So we're just getting there.
Your question about the family, I think that related. We also did a study on the neighborhood effects in all this, and one of our hypotheses for future research is that some of these young kids in elementary school, they don't know they're not in Mexico for a while. Then I think that's a protective effect. It's like a bubble. But then as they get older, they start to realize that they're not part of the mainstream culture, or they are an ethnic minority group, and they start to get all these messages that for a while they don't get, because they're in this protective environment. Mm-hmm. Then I think that's another element that we need to continue to study, you know, the effects of neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And when they go to the middle school, usually they're a little bit farther away from home. And that creates, it's amazing what 3 or 4 blocks, the difference that makes in the life of a young person. And then the diversity, not in a positive way, diversity in this case, diversity means new stressors, that a new issue of identity, who am I, and who people think I am. And then in this case in Arizona, all these anti-immigrant sentiment and behaviors are going on, and the kids, as they get older, are much more exposed.
Exactly. Did I see another hand? In the back, or, okay. A little louder. Oh, terrific.
It's always the same package, you know, we always see the same thing. There's a poor neighborhood, there's in the first generation immigrants, it seems like the family structure is still there, and things are working well. They're just poor, the parents like to access things, and they're doing the things, the kids kind of, the children fall into place. If that does not work, then the second generation, they're really, that's when you have the mental illnesses, the stigmatism is not to go anywhere, you have the drugs. They're available all the time, you know, but the first generation or the second generation Mexican, and I'm talking about the really poor educated ones, and they usually have 6 grade education, and the men in 8th grade, so they're from Mexico, but it seems like it's the neighborhood of the availability of the drugs, which I would like to have studied more with the second generation, how do you break that cycle? If something was wrong, listen. Once you get into the culture, in the first generation, how can we fix it so the second generation does not fall apart? I guess that's one.
Any comments from the panel on the comment?
Has there been any studies done on that one?
Neighborhoods.
First and second generation.
Neighborhoods. I don't know.
As far as the effect of the neighborhood, well, some of our work has looked at differences, neighborhood effects on substance use among middle school kids, mostly again in Phoenix and Mexican heritage kids for the most part. And we do find some small effects at the neighborhood level. And that this bubble, the higher the percentage of immigrants in the neighborhood, the more the protective bubble seems to apply for
less acculturated kids. But the thing that we struggle with is what's a neighborhood? And just as Dr. Marsilio was saying, sometimes these kids are in neighborhoods where there's a carniceria, there are all sorts of ethnic establishments, but some kids are going to schools that take them outside of those neighborhoods in middle school. And so their neighborhood in some ways expands, and our definitions of the neighborhood, I think, are not, we use definitions that are supplied by demographers, not by how neighborhoods are defined within the community. And that's what makes me, I think the neighborhood effects are probably stronger than we're estimating. It's just that we don't know how to define the neighborhood in the way that it's experienced. It may be an even stronger effect. What we find is a fairly small one, but it exists. A protective bubble.
I think one other question in the second row there.
My question is more on the methods to identify mental health illness. And I think most of you, I came in a little late, but we're using sort of quantitative methods where you are asking people questions and trying to be able to put people into categories of depression and schizophrenia and things like that. And I mean, we've been having a serious problem in Chicago quantitating depression in some of our studies. People crying during parts of the interview out of total despair, and yet their best depression index score is normal. So when they go to answer the questions, trying to assess if we cannot capture it using these scales that perform reasonably well in other populations. And yet I think most of us would agree that these numbers are probably underestimates as to the reality. But I worry that we're attributing these underestimates to people not recognizing that they have this illness, they're not recognizing these terms, and that maybe the answer is more qualitative methods where we try and sit down with people and figure out exactly what is it in your mind that's happening with depression, so we can understand that it's not, you're not thinking, maybe the actions are so terrible that perhaps they answered your questions the way they did, because what's the point of going to a psychologist? Why would I ever answer go to a psychologist for depression? Who can go to a psychologist? You know, so I just worry that we're making assumptions about things because of the limitations of our methods, and that maybe qualitative methods might be able to help us.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an interesting point. In, you know, Mexico has very, very low service availability of mental health or substance use treatment. So, you know, certainly if it's not even available, how are you going to sort of recognize the symptoms? And you might, you know, be expressing your symptoms as something else, right, rather than what we would say here, you know, following the DSM-4, whatever it is that we're trying to follow in terms of labeling of illness. And so I think that certainly is an issue, you know, in terms of our patients, our people are, you know, certainly under-recognizing their own needs, potentially, because
there's some amount of... But I'm not sure they're under-recognizing. Mm-hmm. I just think that the way that we're capturing it is we're trying to force them to come up with a diagnostic category,
right,
which is meaningless.
Right. So why do the plus restricted in some ways?
Yeah.
What access is there? Because if I know I don't have access to it, why to bother?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then if I know, if I'm documented, and I know that the providers don't understand me anyway, then there is no quality of care, then why to bother? Then we have the issue of access and quality of care.
One way that she touched with the point is the aspect that we are so strict in the diagnosis for have depression or depression.
Mm-hmm.
We're not allowed to have minor depression, so syndrome of depression in the scenario. And I believe that is one way that needs to come in outside in the field. It's currently used with the patient care, but there's no hitting mainstream yet. I believe that is the need for that research.
Gracias. We are running out of time, but I'm going to let the last person in the row speak before.
I agree with Dr. Mark. I'm so excited that you're here. Like, oh, I know that person. I loved the mental health literacy study, and my colleague and I had submitted a grant to study because it's so rarely studied. But when you were giving the data, I thought, wow, you know, interpretation of this data, you know, there's a lot of room for how we interpret it. And to go back to the question that you asked, which was very good, that there's a lot of literature in sociology. Like I'm thinking of the Portis and Rombart. I don't know if you're familiar with, you know, about the second generation and first generation.
Mm-hmm.
But I do wonder, when it comes to mental health, when somebody defines
talking about people, is that really more of an indicator of treatment preferences and needing someone to talk to, and whether or not it's, and so it may be a literacy question, but it also, I wonder, it's like, how much of it is it also a treatment presence, and the fact that because they're defining it that way, it makes it better for them to cope with it, because if you think you have something chronic and long-term, that's more stressful than thinking, okay, this is a situational as a result of this cultural transition that they're making. This is just an observation of the wonderful presentation that you guys have made.
Well, this was asked, I mean, we're asking participants in a vignette to just, you know, and describe a person, not themselves, but to describe somebody else. And I guess it's a philosophical slant or an ideological slant that I really look at mental illness as treatable disorders. And I'm certainly right there with you that there's multiple ways in which people can get informal help, and from on the front end of that, in terms of how to handle stress and how to handle different issues so that you don't slip into a major depression, or you don't slip into a psychotic episode. At some point, though, you know, believe me, I have my community psychology roots, my public health roots to all of this, but I do believe, much like, you know, there's things that we can do to prevent a heart attack, but once you start to exhibit signs and symptoms of a heart attack, the best thing to do is to get professional help. And I feel the same way about mental health issues. And so when I hear this dialogue, I'm very supportive of, there's informal networks, clergy, family can be very helpful. It's being able to, in the network analysis, to be able to find out where in your network of family and friends where you can actually seek help and get effective response to that. But at some point also, I think we tend to put too much of our, faith in those approaches working effectively, and I don't know if we're doing our populations that we're working, I don't know if we're doing a good thing for the populations that we're working with if we come across that way, because we sort of then facilitate that mindset that you know, I don't really need to go for help. So I think that all comes back to mental health literacy. I think it all comes back to, there are things that we can do to prevent this from happening, there are things that we can do that we're struggling, but there are things that we can do when those particular strategies aren't working, and that this is time now when we can go get professional help. The other issue is, yes, why even pursue that if there aren't any providers out there that will treat me, which is a huge issue. And even if the ones that are, they're not culturally competent to be able to effectively work with immigrant populations. So
it's a very nice actually.
Well, thank you again on behalf of the Latino Caucus Scientific Session. Thank you for participation. I know there's many sessions, so thank you for coming, and hope you submit a call for abstract for next year. Thank you.